So we are continuing our study of Brahman Purusha Ishvara, Maya Prakriti Shakti. And where we are right now, Sri Aurobindo has entered the last phase of this chapter where he's talking about these principles that give the title to the chapter. And he has come finally to the third principle, which is the Ishvara Shakti principle. And if we recollect last time, he validated that principle as being the one that actually brings together everything else. It's the relationship between Ishvara and Shakti that mediates or manifests the relationship between Brahman and Maya, and on the other hand, between Purusha and Prakriti. And we mentioned, I mentioned last time that these three dual terms are terms that appear in different layers of Indic spiritual philosophy and belong, as it were, to different kinds of orders. And in, later in India, we have what are called the darshans, that these darshans are different schools of philosophy that have slightly different perspectives on reality. The one set of six darshans actually goes to a more universal plane where you have a number of them actually which believe in the primacy of the Veda. And then we also have another set of six darshans, which some of which believe in the primacy of the Veda, and it includes schools that don't, which is Buddhism, Jainism, and atheism. And on the other hand, there's another six schools that believe in the primacy of the Veda. These are all Vedic darshans, what are called Astika, and that today we use the term Hinduism to refer to this whole bunch. And of them, some of the schools pertain to what we are talking about now. One of them is Sankhya. Actually, another one is yoga, but Sankhya and yoga are very closely connected, though yoga has a little difference in that yoga believes in a supreme lord. The word Ishvara occurs in yoga, but does not occur in Sankhya. Gita later validates the term Ishvara and actually also uses the term Purusha and couches itself in terms of Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta. So the other school, which is Vedanta, introduces the term Purusha, but also introduces the term Ishvara, primarily of initially Isha, which is the same as Ishvara. And then we find that later philosophies such as the Tantras pay a lot of attention to Shakti, are based on Shakti, and on the relationship between Ishvara and Shakti. And that becomes actually the basis of all the modern schools of Hinduism that are based on the Agamas, that are a marriage between the Tantras and the Puranas. The yoga side of the Agamas is about the relationship between Ishvara and Shakti. Now, the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti is seen as a static thing in Sankhya. But if we bring it into closer connection with Vedanta, we see that Purusha is introduced in Vedanta as the original person, what the Gita later calls Purushottama, the experiencer, the one being as experiencer. And Purusha, the word Prakriti is not used in the Upanishads or in Vedanta, but the Supreme Being or whatever being is maps itself into a cosmos that is characterized by planes of consciousness. These planes of consciousness can be thought of as the Vedantic approach to Prakriti. In other words, these are the substantial media, the substance media in which Purusha experiences and in which Purusha has its actions or whatever activities. It is also the energy. Each one of these planes of consciousness, because they are conscious, provides a certain kind of activity. And that activity is carried out by Shakti. So, bringing all this together, Sri Aurobindo has looked at the two sides of Brahman and Maya, has looked at the two sides of Purusha and Prakriti, and he is now looking at the two sides of Ishvara and Shakti, which are, we may say from a certain point of view, in the limited sense in which Sankhya gives it, Purusha and Prakriti seem to be the relationship between a observer, a conscious being, and the automatisms of nature, impersonal automatisms of nature, in the universe that we find ourselves in. It describes the phenomenal cosmos. Brahman and Maya seem to be transcendental concepts, concepts that exceed our cosmos, concepts of reality as it is. Brahman being the supreme reality, conscious reality, conscious of itself, and Maya being the consciousness of that reality that can be coeval with that reality. In other words, it's nothing other than Brahman, it's Brahman as consciousness. Sri Aurobindo will talk about these two in a certain way as the passive Brahman and the active Brahman. Passive Brahman is that same reality that is transcendental and has infinite, radically infinite potential. And active Brahman would be that in creation, that creating, self-creating, its potencies. We'll get into that a little more today in these paragraphs that appear. So Ishvara Shakti mediating between these two would be a cosmic reality. Cosmic not only in the sense of our cosmos, which is the cosmos that Vedanta would call the cosmos of avidya, but any possible cosmos, any possible creation. So we have a transcendental reality, which is in a way all there is. We have a phenomenal reality, which is what we find ourselves in, and we have a cosmic reality, which is a creative, self-manifestation of worlds in which entities are related to each other, both as we find it as well as every possibility beyond that. So with that, I think we can start. Last time, after introducing Ishvara, Sri Aurobindo, as Ishvara, he also looks at from the viewpoint of its etymology as the one who has will, Isha, and that will is what is manifest in the world and made active through Shakti or power, conscious power, power of consciousness. And we find that Sri Aurobindo actually gives a certain kind of primacy to this relationship, but also discusses the problem of personality and impersonality. Because if we think about Ishvara, then we start thinking about the Lord. At a certain place, Sri Aurobindo talks about the different parts of our being and what kind of relations they have with reality. And Parabrahman, Supreme Brahman, can appear to these parts in different ways. So to our our mind, it can appear as the principle of Brahman. It's like a principle that is impersonal, an impersonal transcendental principle. To our phenomenal existence, it can appear as Para Brahman would be in that sense also at an individualized level Paramatman. So the mind would approach Para Brahman as Paramatman, and then to the vital it would appear as a supreme lord. In other words, there is one overlord of the entire cosmos whose bidding is being done by everything, and we are also doing its bidding. That particular approach to Brahman is that of the vital, and that is Parameshwara, Supreme Ishwara. And to the psychic, which is the deepest self in us, the divine self in us, it is the Supreme Person, Purushottama. So here, of course, he's using the word Purusha very differently from the way in which it's used in the Sankhya. He's using it as it is used in the Gita. But Purushottama as Supreme Person is how he is also describing Ishwara over here. And as we saw in the previous paragraph, he pointed out that this Ishwara is not merely impersonal, but it is also impersonal. This Ishwara is not merely will, but it is also the person. And this person is not merely personal, but it is also impersonal. And that he shows as the limitation of an anthropomorphic approach to the divine, which is that if we want to see the divine as a person, we somehow make that person as a magnified version of the human. That is a superhuman, a human with infinitely magnified capacities of the human. Maybe all the good capacities, but just that. While he's saying over here that even there, however much we may magnify it, it would be a finiteness and a kind of a unbounded finite, as he calls it elsewhere. Either a bounded infinite or an unbounded finite, but there are bounds to it. And he points out that such a description of the Ishwara is not an adequate description. That impersonality is its very nature, because in a sense impersonality allows infinity to be psychologically mapped onto the person. That's the prerogative of an infinite person. Now it's interesting how Sri Aurobindo goes about bringing this out, because as we can imagine that this kind of a equation, or this kind of a perspective on reality, is a type of theism. It's a type of giving greatest importance to God with a capital G as a person. But at the same time, he's taking pains to divest us of any illusion of this person as being some kind of magnified king who sort of, is like a kind of an overlord who yet is much greater, but made in the human image. So this type of a theology, a theistic theology, is, if we look at it in terms of the Indian traditions, very close to Vaishnavism. And indeed, Sri Aurobindo does have his entire inner yogic path, his own yogic path, in connection with Sri Krishna. And so it would make complete sense that, in a way, his his philosophy is mirroring some of the tenets of Vaishnavism. We also find that in Vaishnavism, particularly Gaudiya Vaishnavism, this same thing about the impersonality and the personality are proposed. In other words, rather than making the impersonal greater than the personal is made greater than the impersonal. But at the same time, the impersonality is made into an attribute of the person. So we find over here, so like for in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, they will say that Brahman, as the Vedantins talk about it, as the impersonal infinite being, is the aura of Sri Krishna. That's the aura of Sri Krishna. You have to pass through it to get to the person, which is the center of the circumferenceless circle that we may call Brahman. And here we say, in that paragraph just preceding where we are right now, the last paragraph, we see if we look at things from a larger point of view, we might say that what is impersonal is only a power of the person. Existence itself has no meaning without an existent. Consciousness has no standing place if there is none who is conscious. Delight is useless and invalid without an enjoyer. Love can have no foundation of fulfillment if there is no lover. All power must be otios if there is not an almighty. So this is where he takes all these attributes, the attributes of the existent, which is the principle through which the mind knows things, consciousness and delight, power, which are all properties of the vital, and then you have love, which is a property of the psychic. And all these need a person to manifest their qualities in an existence. So this is why he's saying, for what we mean by person is conscious being. And indeed, person is conscious being. And in the Vedantic sense, that is what Purusha is. Purusha is person. And in fact, etymologically, it is most possible, most probable that the Indo-European words person and Purusha refer to the same thing. So with that, I think we can move on to the new paragraph, if we admit the divine being, unless there are some questions or comments which we can take up and then move on.
I can read the next paragraph.
Sure.
If we admit the divine being, the supreme person and all person as the Ishvara, a difficulty arises in understanding his rule or government of world existence, because we immediately transfer to him our mental conception of a human ruler. We picture him as acting by the mind and mental will in an omnipotent, arbitrary fashion upon a world on which he imposes his mental conceptions as laws, and we conceive of his will as a free caprice of his personality. But there is no need for the divine being to act by an arbitrary will or idea as an omnipotent yet ignorant human being, if such an omnipotence were possible, might do. For he is not limited by mind. He has an all consciousness in which he is aware of the truth of all things, and aware of his own all wisdom working them out according to the truth that is in them, their significance, their possibility or necessity, the imperative selfness of their nature. The divine is free and not bound by laws of any making, but still he acts by laws and processes because they are the expression of the truth of things, not their mechanical, mathematical or other outward truth alone, but the spiritual reality of what they are, what they have become and have yet to become, what they have it within themselves to realize. He is himself present in the working, but he also exceeds and can overrule it. For on one side, nature works according to her limited complex of formulas and is informed and supported in their execution by the divine presence. But on the other side, there is an overseeing, a higher working and determination. Even an intervention, free but not arbitrary, often appearing to us magical and miraculous because it proceeds and acts upon nature from a divine supernature. Nature here is a limited expression of the supernature and open to intervention or mutation by its light, its force, its influence. The mechanical, mathematical, automatic law of things is a fact, but within it there is a spiritual law of consciousness at work, which gives to the mechanical steps of nature's forces an inner turn and value, a significant rightness, and a secretly conscious necessity. And above it, there is a spiritual freedom that knows and acts in the supreme and universal truth of the spirit. Our view of the divine government of the world, or of the secret of its action, is either incurably anthropomorphic, or else incurably mechanical. Both the anthropomorphism and mechanism have their elements of truth, but they are only a side, an aspect. And the real truth is that the world is governed by the one in all and over all who is infinite in his consciousness, and it is according to the law and logic of an infinite consciousness that we ought to understand the significance and building and movement of the universe.
So, if in the previous paragraph he was talking about the problem of personality and impersonality in thinking about a god, Ishvara as a god, now he's looking at that other problem of rulership, of power. And here, as he's pointing out, this is something that is normal to our human minds. And we find this very patently, for example, in theistic schools in the West, in Western conceptions of God, where God is a creator God, that there is a distinction between God and his creation. The creation is made with laws, tied with laws, and the creator is he who has made the laws, and the creatures are those who follow those laws of God's making. And of course, this is one particular philosophical view, a theological philosophy, which has created a lot of problems and continues to, because this is the view that says that we should not tamper with the laws of God, for example. That is one particular stand that people have taken. In the East, where there is a greater fuzziness between God and man, there is yet the same conception at a subjective level, that even if in some sense consciousness can come closer to this God, can have experiences of nearness, you know, what is called salokya, or even experiences of identity, sayujya, or, you know, yoga with this supreme being, yet as far as the world is concerned, we are in a relationship to this being as the relationship of subjects and king. So that there are laws made by the king, and we are following those laws. And those laws are immutable, mechanical. Now, a lot of schools, even in modern times, have validated these kinds of approaches within Hinduism. And some of them do so not in a very a clear manner, that there is a fuzziness because they cannot completely negate the monism of Vedanta, yet there is an intuition regarding the ordered nature of the cosmos and man's place in that order as being something which is fixed. The Brahmo religion, for example, which arose in modern times in India and Bengal, and Sri Aurobindo was very familiar with. He married into the Brahmo family. His wife was from a Brahmo family. His father himself was an atheist, but had close dealings with the Brahmos. They have a similar sort of belief. Though they are based in Vedanta, they have a very strong belief that the whole creation, what we can call a creation, has been made by God for his adulation. That is the proper relationship of the creation to the Creator. So Islam has that same idea again. Now, Sri Aurobindo is saying that this kind of an idea is arising out of a mental conception of omnipotence, of what kind of a magnified human being as Lord of a creation would possess. Capacities by which it creates certain laws, and then those laws are basically what holds the cosmos together. But as he has pointed out, Brahman is completely free and Ishvara is completely free. Ishvara as Lord is completely free and has become this cosmos. In other words, there is nothing in this cosmos that is not Ishvara. As a result, everything is completely free, but they do not experience themselves as free. If they don't experience themselves as free, it is not because some arbitrary laws have been imposed upon them, but because whatever we call laws are also self-presentations of the same Brahman. These laws are not creations in a sense, but are self-presentations of the truths of Brahman. And within those self-presentations, the Brahman, the Ishvara himself is present as conscious being in relation with those laws. Now this we can see from the viewpoint again of Ishvara, of Purusha and Prakriti. If we are to look at that Creator Self, if we are to look at the one whose will has become this cosmos as Purusha, and the laws by which the cosmos seems to be held together as Prakriti, then that is our phenomenal experience. But what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out is that these laws are actually the self-presentation of this being, and the creatures are also self-presentations of this being. And the creatures contain within themselves the power to change these laws by intervention, not by their limited means at this point, but because there is a kind of a direct identity between Ishvara, the laws of Ishvara, and the Ishvara present in every creature. There is the possibility of entering into certain types of relations which by the freedom of Ishvara can change the laws of Ishvara. This is what he's calling intervention. This is again a very major theological point. It's called interventionism. Does the divine have any power over his world? Or even if he has power over this world, does he exercise his power over this world? Now, the point that's being made is, yes, not only does he exercise power over this world, but also by the creature's power of being the same as Ishvara, these laws can be changed through a variety of devices. So, this is what he's bringing out over here. And the relationship between Ishvara, the world of laws and their actions, which is the Shakti or the power of Ishvara, and the souls who are within that world of nature or of Shakti, are one. The three are one. And the so-called divine government of the world is neither the government by some being who is separate from the creation and rules it like an autocrat, nor, however wise, nor, which is what he calls the incurably anthropomorphic view, nor is it a world of laws in which creatures are trapped and which has no relationship to that particular being who sits in his throne on high and just receives the adulation of the people, which is what he calls an incurably mechanical view. So it's neither incurably anthropomorphic nor incurably mechanical. It is bridged by consciousness, and it is conscious. The whole thing is the self-manifestation of Ishvara, and that self-manifestation is also the self-exploration of Ishvara, both through the nature, or what we can call Prakriti or Shakti, and through the experience of beings within that nature. Yeah, Lupa.
Yep. So the form that we give to Ishvara as a person, that is also anthropomorphism?
Yeah, that is also anthropomorphism. That's the reason why, if you look at the Hindu tradition, we find that we complicate this form by giving it multiple hands, multiple heads, and things like that. And then we complicate it even further in scriptures like the Gita, in the idea of the Vishwarupa, where we find something which is completely incomprehensible in terms of a description. It's completely, if you call it anthropomorphic, it completely challenges every description which is formal. But at the same time, because of that, Arjuna says that he cannot take it anymore, and he asks him to return to his quote-unquote four-handed form. Now, this four-handed form would make this Ishvara into somebody who is yet made in the image of man, but made in a kind of a magnified image of man, like a kind of a superman of a still anthropomorphic character. But this is the point he's making, that it's still a transition out of the anthropomorphic that we know into, you know, as a step towards the kind of complete freedom that includes all forms and goes beyond mental conception that the Vishwarupa presents. The world of the gods could be conceived as a magnified cosmic type of anthropomorphism. That's what is being pointed out. But it is still not the supreme Ishvara. The supreme Ishvara is what the Vishwarupa would. It's incomprehensible to the human form.
And Devashita, by anthropomorphism, we are also including zoomorphism.
No, we are not including zoomorphism. This is one of the, of course, zoomorphism is another kind of sort of thing, because again, in the Indian tradition, a lot of the gods are hybrids between man and animal, which is a kind of zoomorphism. But the reason why he's saying anthropomorphism even more, because that statement is there in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that man was created in the image of God. And so the idea that has become a major debating point in today's world, because a lot of people are taking it in the other direction. They're saying that does not include a zoomorphism. In other words, why is it that man was made more in the image of God than other animals? Now, of course, we have that in some of our Upanishads as well. We have the Aitiriya Upanishad that points out that other animals were paraded before the gods, and the gods didn't find them adequate and finally entered into the human being. But zoomorphism would also be a kind of a limitation on the infinity of this person, this infinite person. It would include zoomorphism, anthropomorphism, and go beyond them. But in general, I think that when we talk about anthropomorphism, as he's pointing out over here, there is a kind of human hubris in which we exclude the animal as well, sort of thinking of God as a magnified human.
So, Debashish, is he privileging the Nirakar Brahman followers like the Brahmo Samaj and Islam?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
He's completely going against the Nirakar followers. That's the point I was making. His is a theism through and through. But it is a kind of a theism. See, the Brahmo followers and all, as I pointed out, believe in a god, a Nirakar god, but they do not believe that man can become god.
Okay, so in this paragraph, he has not actually answered the question, the problems that the Nirakar Brahman followers would fall into.
No, he has not addressed those problems, but he has touched on them in the previous paragraph where he's talking about the personal and the impersonal.
And he has already privileged the personal above the impersonal.
Yeah. But the personal doesn't need to have form. That's the point. I mean, but the Nirakar has no form. The personal can have a form which is beyond mental understanding.
Mm-hmm.
What we might call an infinite form. This is exactly what the Gita gives us, actually. The Gita is not a Nirakar text. The Gita is a kind of a, you know, supramental Akar text.
Mm-hmm.
What does Nirakar and Akar mean?
Akar means form. Nirakar means formless.
Okay.
During Ramakrishna Dev's time, these debates were on, right, because of the Brahmo Samaj. So he used to ask a lot of his devotees, what do you believe in, Akar, Sakar or Nirakar? And he used to sort of confuse them, like this main scribe, M, Mahendra Gupta, he confuses him and Mahendra Gupta doesn't know what to answer. And Sri Ramakrishna Dev smiles and says, doesn't matter. You can believe in either at this stage.
Yeah, right. Which is, of course, later the mission, the Ramakrishna mission, or what they call over here the Vedanta societies, pitched their emphasis on the side of the formless, particularly because of Vivekananda. But many people, of course, now are saying that that was not even Vivekananda's real pitch, that happened sort of by doctrinaire means.
By that you mean doctrinaire in the sense the Brahmo Samaj doctrine?
No, the Ramakrishna mission doctrine. They created their own doctrines and sort of selectively privileged certain texts of Vivekananda and even Ramakrishna, for that matter, to make it look like they were actually, that he was privileging Nirakar over Akar.
And it happened after Vivekananda passed on?
Yeah.
When you say made it look like, are you saying that it was like a conscious attempt to privilege or an unconscious mistake because of, because of people's own biases?
Probably conscious attempt because, you see, one of the things is that's itself a big study as to why, this privileging of the Nirakar took such an important place in modern times in Hindu philosophy. It did, because in response to the West, it was felt to be more quote-unquote rational than to talk about these multi-headed or kind of anthropomorphic or, to go to where Sri Aurobindo, to talk like this, like Sri Aurobindo does, where he's including the two and yet privileging the person, it takes a very complex presentation. That's why the supramental is an inclusive complexity beyond the mind. And that was not conceived or conceptualized philosophically, either by Ramakrishna or Vivekananda. That's partly the reason why they had to put their weight behind the Nirakar as a more rational formulation.
Thank you.
Devashish, this Nirakar, this particular term, sort of reminds me of that, some of the, I don't remember their names, some of the Western philosophers' logic against atheists. Like, if even by saying there is no God, you are actually giving reality to something as God and then negating it. So if we take it in that regard, then, nirakar meaning you are actually considering akar as something totally crystallized and then discarding it. Is that making sense?
Yeah, it's like a transcendentalism which says that there is a world of form, so whoever is supreme must be beyond it. You know, so we actually talk about divine having form and then try to go beyond it. But still, what is not addressed over there is that there can be a form that is way beyond whatever we can conceive of as form. So it remains within the domain of negations. That's the thing that...
So it is like no and beyond are two different things, right?
Yeah.
No are and beyond akar are right. Two different things.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. These distinctions will remain only within the domain of mind. As he's saying over here, if the divine is illimitable beyond the domain of mind, then these distinctions of whether he's nirakar or has akar will kind of not be able to adequately encompass that being.
Margaret Faines, would you like to read next?
Oh, yes. If we regard this aspect of the one reality and put it in close connection with the other aspects, we can get a complete view of the relation between the eternal self-existence and the dynamics of the consciousness force by which it manifests the universe. If we place ourselves in a silent self-existence, immobile, static, inactive, it will appear that a conceptive consciousness force, Maya, able to effectuate all its conceptions, a dynamic consort of the self of silence, is doing everything. It takes its stand on the fixed, unmoving eternal status and casts the spiritual substance of being into all manner of forms and movements to which its passivity consents or in which it takes its impartial pleasure, its immobile delight of creative and mobile existence. Whether this be a real or an illusory existence, that must be its substance and significance. Consciousness is at play with being. Force of nature does what it wills with existence and makes it the stuff of her creations, but secretly the consent of the being must be there at every step to make this possible. There is an evident truth in this perception of things. It is what we see happening everywhere in us and around us. It is a truth of the universe and must answer to a fundamental truth aspect of the absolute. But when we step back from the outer dynamic appearances of things, not into a witness silence, but into an inner, dynamic, participating experience of the spirit, we find that this consciousness force, Maya, Shakti, is itself the power of the being, the self-existent, the Ishvara. The being is Lord of her and of all things. We see him doing everything in his own sovereignty as the creator and ruler of his own manifestation, or if he stands back and allows freedom of action to the forces of nature and her creatures, his sovereignty is still innate in the permission at every step, his tacit sanction, let it be so, tathatsu, is there implicit, for otherwise nothing could be done or happen. Being and its consciousness force, spirit and nature cannot be fundamentally dual. What nature does is really done by the spirit. This too is a truth that becomes evident when we go behind the veil and feel the presence of a living reality, which is everything and determines everything, is the all-powerful and the all-ruler. This too is a fundamental truth aspect of the Absolute.
So as we see, he is trying to go back to a monism over here, and from the previous way he posited these three, the Lord, the world of laws made by the Lord, and the experience of the creatures of that world, here we see that he is taking it back to the origin in the one Brahman. And so how is that these three, or that Lord and the world of laws, related to that Brahman? And so he's trying to give us what we can call, and you know, we talk about thought experiments. This is also a kind of thought experiment, but it's more like a consciousness experiment. It goes beyond the thought experiment. And essentially what he's saying is exactly what he himself experienced, which is that his first major experience was that of the silent self. And in the experience of the silent self, everything became unreal. And there seemed to be nothing that could be said about the world. The world seemed to be a set of shadows. But still, even if we say that it is a set of shadows on a cinema screen, as he describes it in his poem, still, why do those shadows take the form that they do? What gives them the kind of logic with which they have a certain type of existence, you know, which cannot be denied? Where does that all come from? What are the laws that bind it, and where do those laws come from? And Sri Aurobindo was to say that by the time he got into Alipur jail, which was in a year's time after the experience of the silent, you know, self of silence, as he says, he came to his second major realization, which was that the world is itself that same being that is creating out of its own substance all the forms that we see around us, the laws by which those forms are developed and put into relation with each other, and the drift of the cosmos. So this is where he conceived of the idea of an active Brahman and a passive Brahman. In other words, we can say that whatever we are calling Brahman is transcendentally infinite. That there is, as the Vedantic equation of knowledge says, there is the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. The unknowable is unknowable because it is ever transcendentally infinite. We can always sink into it and know its silence beyond any possibility of cosmos. And it is an absolute silence. It's a silence that doesn't have any need to be anything else. But at the same time, this absolute infinity that can be completely passive to itself can also experience itself in infinite ways. these can be coexistent realities. And if we talk about a active Brahman, if we talk about movement, we are talking about a certain dimension. That is the dimension of time. In other words, this same passive Brahman can experience itself in through a variety of dimensions, one of which is the dimension of time. As soon as it experiences itself through the dimension of time, it becomes active. Its powers and possibilities start emerging. And that is exactly a certain kind of deployment of consciousness along whatever conceptive order that it turns upon itself. Now, to even speak like this is only a matter of speaking, because if this is the absolute, then time is only a dimension to it. But to us, time is a reality within which we have our beings. And hence we cannot really talk about reality both as being beyond time and within time. Again, it is a dimension beyond our mental ability to articulate, as it were. But these two self-appearances, coexistent self-appearances of Brahman, a passive Brahman and an active Brahman, which otherwise could be called a Brahman and a Maya, Brahman and Maya, are in relation with each other, because this dimension, this time dimension, is actually also drawing from this infinite silence with infinite potentiality, which it is bringing into activity, which it is bringing into a becoming. Being is being brought into a becoming. And that is what Maya is doing. But the becoming is nothing but the becoming of being. And therefore, it is being itself that is present even in the way in which it is being brought into the becoming. See, so this is the inner dynamic participating experience of the spirit, as he's saying. So we find that these two infinities, a passive infinity and an active infinity, are ultimately the same being that has entered into a certain dimension of itself, a self-manifesting dimension. And in that dimension, it is creating conditions for its own rebirth. Every condition through which it may present itself becomes a condition through which that same passive Brahman will reappear, either as a creature, a person, or as the laws by which this creature and person are to appear. So that dualism is implicit in time, in that time dimension. It's implicit in being brought into becoming from a being. And he's saying that that is being done, as it were, by deploying its own force of consciousness, which is conceptive force of consciousness. It's Maya. Or by now he's calling it both Maya and Shakti, which relies on the implicit consent of being to enter into every one of its infinite possibilities, going beyond anything that we can, the limits of our own conception. Every possibility that cannot even be conceived by us is part of Brahman's reality. And every one of these possibilities is manifesting Brahman. And if they are to manifest Brahman in time, they are appearing or emerging at a certain point through the relationship between the forces that are have been presented. And in that, Brahman comes to rest. And so that sanction by which Brahman, implied sanction, by which Brahman says yes to everything that Maya asks of it, is what he's calling tathastu, let it be so. It is in that implied or conscious consent that the self-becoming of being is occurring from passive Brahman to active Brahman. That's the reason why he says that this active Brahman is also Brahman, that this active Brahman is also nothing other than Ishvara. Ishvara is not just a passive Lord, but Ishvara is his whole creation. And Ishvara is every law in that creation, and Ishvara is every creature in that creation. And in all these, he is this all-powerful, free, self-creating being.
Vashistha, this is the Anumanta aspect, correct? So there is also the Karta aspect, and in that, I think it's Aitareya Upanishad where it says in the beginning there was just the Asat or non-existent, and then it, the non-existent, decided to create the existent. So the very first thing wasn't the Anumanta act, but it was a Karta act. Or as the doer, he first manifested himself and not as the consenter.
Yeah, yes. Now this is what you're talking about. Of course, it's in the Aitareya Upanishad, that is in even in the Nasadiya Sukta, etc. of the Veda. This is just a manner of speaking. Active Brahman and passive Brahman, there's no priority. It's for us to establish priorities as an approach to that. These realities are coexisting realities. It's just another dimension. It's not which came first. As soon as you say which came first, you're speaking in terms of time. And what is time to one who has actually created the dimension of time? There is no priority there. That is only a manner of speaking created for our convenience, depending on how you want to see it. That Upanishad wants to see it like that. That's all.
Okay, so when we said that Prakriti asks something and the Purusha consents, it's not always that Prakriti asks. It's sometimes that the Purusha also initiates that the desire to do something and Prakriti picks it up.
It is always that. It is always that. From a monistic point of view, that is the case. You're right. But the reason why he's putting it like this is that he's, as he's pointing out, he's asking us to create a kind of a experience, experiment. And in that experiment, he's taking us first outside of Prakriti. He's taking us into this primordial silence. And then from that silence, he's saying that, in fact, that silence is also present in the activity. It is present as an implied consent. This is the point he is making. And this is always going to be true also. I mean, the asat or the nasat is always going to be part of the whole reality, because the reality is radically infinite. If it is radically infinite, there will be an infinite amount of it which will be passive at any time. And yet, it is out of that, out of the mysterious depths of that, that any kind of consent has come. And anything that is happening by the consent of that. See, so that's what he's pointing out. But nevertheless, that consent implies that there is an activity there. That it is neither the passive nor the active Brahman that can be taken apart from one another. And the active Brahman can be thought of as Prakriti, but Prakriti is nothing other than Purusha. This is basically what he's trying to say. Mm-hmm.
That's why Sri Aurobindo puts this knowledge will hyphenated.
Yeah, right.
And that's why when we're trying to explain in our mental language, we are just trying to privilege and stumbling in words. And
Right. But we have to start from somewhere, and that's why, see, the kind of starting point for us, the empirical starting point, is our own experience. And in our experience, that's why the Sankhya is something so powerful because it starts with our own experience. This is how we experience things in a divided way. We can separate Purusha and Prakriti. And if we separate Purusha and Prakriti, we have arrived at a certain kind of a degree of modicum of freedom. And then from there we can find another relation. We can find a new relation in which the two are one.
Devashish, is it true that just because of this discussion and thinking that this, even the existence of these two, Purusha and Prakriti, is actually something that belongs to the domain of time?
Absolutely, exactly. The domain of time, the existence of a time dimension immediately creates a certain type of Brahman existence which has this relationship between Purusha and Prakriti within it.
So basically this differentiation between Purusha and Prakriti, this whole schema, whole structure, it's actually it's a creation of that one of those grades of consciousness which created time.
Absolutely. If we say that time was created, if we say that time is a dimension that eternally exists, it's an eternal self, it's like almost like a body part of that particular being, then we must say that that this is one of its self manifestations that is eternal. Time is just one of its realities. In which case, like, he will point out that, you know, already the duality is implicit, the one outside of time and the one as time. Even if we say, don't say inside of time, or the one who has become time, the one as time and the one not as time, already a duality is implicit over there. And he's basically going to say that that one as time is being manifest through a certain power of itself. Like you said, that must be somewhere in the gradation of consciousness that some power has created time. Well, even if time is never created, yet it exists as that power. The power of time, you may say, the divine power of time. And this is partly why in Sri Aurobindo's own schema, in the record of yoga, the supreme being to him is Krishna, but the counterpart of Krishna is Kali, the power of time.
Yeah, it's like an like a face of that gradation, like, you know, there is a certain poise which has a face, I mean, or an attribute which is time itself.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And that's why he's going to point out that, again, it boils down to where are we? I mean, that Sri Aurobindo never loses his focus on who are we and where are we. We are in this reality of time. We can talk a lot about the timeless and enter getting out of it and all that, but he's pointing out that any fulfillment that we may have must include this dimension of time. It cannot get out of it. If it does get out of it, it's lost its purpose. But if it can find a way by which it can bridge the timeless and time, then it's fulfilled its purpose. And for that, it needs to make its surrender to that being who is time. That's the point he's going to make.
Thank you so much. That's beautiful.
Devashish, could we say that the difficulties that Sri Aurobindo is dealing with in each of these paragraphs is a difficulty of the mind because of the mind's operation by distinction, but it's also, he's also talking about a power of I don't know if it's a power of the mind, but it's a power of manifestation of individual, of this and that, or yes and no, or the manifestation of duality, and so his solution then is to take the mind and just extend it and extend it until it just goes beyond itself to something that's supra to that.
Yeah, you're quite right, John Robert, in the sense that yes, the problem is coming from the mind, because the mind does deal in exclusives. Not just because the mind deals in distinctions, because as you yourself point out, it's true that he is talking about a duality that is not necessarily created by the mind, but a duality that is already present in reality. But it is not an exclusivism. It's not something, it's not two. It's the same one as two. And his solution is, at least so far that we've seen over here, he has two solutions. One is, as you're saying, to be able to make the mind, exercise the mind so that it can actually arrive at least mentally at a certain type of understanding of two and one not being separate. That's what he's gone through in these paragraphs, right, that we are going through right now. He's again and again showing us two and showing the existence of each in the other and how that is what is actually the only one there is. And this kind of method is very interesting, because actually this in modern philosophy is the method of deconstruction. This is exactly the method that Jacques Derrida sort of introduces into modern philosophy, as saying that we have to do this to all the positions of the mind. The mind has to find its implicit biases, see that it is actually privileging something over its opposite, and put the two together and exercise the mind till it finds the one in the other and the other in the one, and then see the two together. This is the method that he's using here. But he's going a little further. He's saying that even doing that is not going to give us a real grasp, an actual experiential grasp over this kind of reality, simultaneous multiplicity. And for that, we have to overstep our own possibilities of experience. And to do that, we have to enter into the experience of the Lord. We have to experience as this one Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti experiences the whole thing. And for that, we have to do yoga and build the, you know, missing links between mind and that which experiences like this being.
Well, doesn't Sri Aurobindo say somewhere that cosmic mind is the creator? I mean, he's not using that terminology here. He's talking about the dynamic power of consciousness as being the creator.
Right. Cosmic mind as creator would be one poise of the dynamic power of consciousness. And if you notice that he says in that paragraph just read, the very first to second sentence, if we place ourselves in a silent self-existence, immobile, static, inactive, it will appear that a conceptive consciousness force, Maya, able to effectuate all its conceptions, a dynamic consort of the self of silence, is doing everything. So this conceptive power, its conceptive shakti, Maya, consciousness force, if it holds a certain concept, If it's manifesting this being along the lines of a certain concept, and if that concept is going to actually be the boundary of the universe, that will be the self-presentation of that being, that could be called the cosmic mind. See, but cosmic mind, Sri Aurobindo talks about overmind maya. Overmind maya is the shakti of the cosmic mind. But here he is talking about something that can spawn that as well as spawn other kinds of conceptions. That conception within which everything is held. And there are many kinds of conceptions. Conceptions in which it knows itself to be the conception. And everything within it knows itself to be that conception. That would not be the cosmic mind, that would be the super mind. And so, though the cosmic mind is the creator of this universe of avidya that we can talk about, the cosmic mind itself is the creation of a greater shakti, which is the supramental shakti. And that runs through and through. Inside that mind, its laws as well as its creatures.
So when we talk about the cosmic mind, or when we talk about mind, we're talking about the avidya. We're talking about distinctions that are hardened into a situation where the realization of unity in the multiplicity is at least the unity is behind and the multiplicity is out in front, or the multiplicity is basically experienced as the real and the unity is hidden.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yes, yes. The separation is, and the separation is made to look real all the way down. That's why the cosmic minds, as creator, you know, again, is a shakti. And inside it must, or to its formulae, must, into its formulae, must enter the substance of reality. In other words, Brahman must enter into its conceptual schemes. And its self-limitation of Brahman, as he pointed out earlier in this paragraph itself, its self-concentration is going to go all the way down to the atoms of separation, materiality as the atomic basis of separation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Devashish, I've got a question about that same...
Yeah, Olga.
The same part that you were just reading, yes. The early part of the paragraph. And it's really about a word, an understanding of what he means by consent. When he says, of being into all manner of forms and movements to which its passivity consents, or in which it takes its impartial pleasure. I can't figure out what he means by consent. And so I'm hoping you can say more about that.
Yeah. So consent is actually here. He's talking about this passive infinity and he's talking about an active infinity. But the active infinity is actually creating forms. And into these forms, this passive infinity is entering. In other words, we may look at it in another way, and that is that this passive infinity is like a certain kind of objectivity. It's the obvious objectivity of matter. If we talk about matter as a objective base, with which we can create objects, which we can describe objectively, to which we can give names, or we can think about the passive transcendent being as a certain kind of objectivity, because ultimately that it's the subject. You know, the subject is also the object to that which is going to give birth to the subject. So if we have a kind of active force, that is in relation with this infinite passivity, but sort of asking each of its infinite potential to appear. You know, I mean, it's like looking at something and saying, you know, are you such and such? And that has to give its consent and say, yes, I am that, right? It is that I am, that is the consent. It is the response to the Shakti, the response to the conceptive power, which is going to give form. But the form is going to be filled in by reality itself, by the whole of reality, only if it gets consent. The consent is implied because there is nothing other than that. But yet it is a consent, because otherwise it will not exist within it. And that's the whole notion of falsehood, where we find that there is something called a relative reality within the cosmos that negates the truth of this infinite being. And such an infinite being, it's like they say, light has a reality, but shadow's reality is based on light. Shadow has no reality in itself. It is based on light. It is only if light consents that shadow can exist. Again, it is only light. Light exists by its self-consent, its implied consent. But the negation of light can also exist if light allows it to exist, you see. So then, as long as light allows its negation to exist, it will exist. In the play, also the negation becomes one particular kind of play. That's also held up by the consent of the player. And this is exactly what he's trying to say over there, that even there, there is a delight. That delight is not actually maybe experienced by us, but the avidya and even the falsehood within the ignorance is something that requires the consent of this being to exist for the sake of the play. It's going to exist because it is the condition under which in time it will lose itself to find itself.
So in that consent, it knows itself.
Yeah, it does know itself. It knows itself. It knows that it is being given an appearance of its own negation. Or it knows that it's being given an appearance of its own self in a certain way, one of the truths of itself. Every form is a truth of its infinite reality.
Thank you, I get it.
Again, some of these difficulties come up again for the same reason, which is that we have to speak about the one and the two at the same time. Even when speaking about the one, we are speaking like about it as a relationship. So this is what he's doing in a way, this looking at things in both the monism and the dualism at the same time, you know, which is exactly the way in which this time dimension manifests.
Should we read the next paragraph?
Sure, let's do that.
Daniel Harris, would you like to read next?
Yeah, sure. Again, if we remain absorbed in the science, the creative consciousness and her works disappear into the silence. Nature and the creation for us to cease to exist or be real. On the other hand, if we look exclusively at the being in its aspect of the sole existent person and ruler, the power of Shakti by which he does all things disappears into his uniqueness or becomes an attribute of his cosmic personality. The absolute monarchy of the one being becomes our perception of the universe. Both these experiences create many difficulties for the mind due to its non-perception of the reality of the self-power, whether in quiescence or in action, or to a too exclusively negative experience of the self, or to the too anthropomorphic character our conceptions attach to the Supreme Being as ruler. It is evident that we are looking at an infinite of which the self-power is capable of many movements, all of them valid. If we look again more largely and take account of both the impersonal and the personal truth of things as one truth, if in that light, the light of personality and impersonality, we see the Bayun aspect of self and self-power, then in the person aspect, a dual person emerges, Ishwara Shakti, the divine self and creator, and the divine mother and creatrix of the universe. There becomes apparent to us the mystery of the masculine and feminine cosmic principles whose play and interaction are necessary for all creation. In the superconscient truth of the self-existence, these two are fused and implied in each other, one and indistinguishable. But in the spiritual pragmatic truth of the dynamism of the universe, they emerge and become active. The Divine Mother energy, as the universal creatrix, Maya, Para-Prakriti, Chit-Shakti, manifests the cosmic self in Ishwara and her own self-power as a dual principle. It is through her that the being, the self, the Ishwara, acts, and he does nothing except by her, through his will, though his will is implicit in her. It is she who works out as the supreme conscious force who holds all souls and beings within her and as executive nature. All exists and acts according to nature. All is the consciousness force manifesting and playing with the being in millions of forms and movements into which she casts his existence. If we draw back from her workings, then all can fall into quiescence and we can enter into the silence because she consents to cease from her dynamic activity. But it is in her quiescence and silence that we are quiescent and cease. If we would affirm our independence of nature, she reveals to us the supreme and omnipresent power of the Ishwara and ourselves as beings of his being. But that power is herself, and we are that in her supernature. If we would realize a higher formation or status of being, then it is still through her, through the divine Shakti, the consciousness force of the spirit, that it has to be done. Our surrender must be to the divine being through the divine mother, for it is towards or unto the supreme nature that our ascension has to take place. And it can only be done by the supernatural Shakti taking up our mentality and transforming it into her super mentality. Thus we see that there is no contradiction or incompatibility between these three aspects of existence, or between them in their eternal status and the three modes of its dynamis working in the universe. One being, one reality as self-basis, supports and forms as Purusha, or conscious being experiences, as Ishwara wills, governs, and possesses its world of manifestation created and kept in motion and action by its own consciousness force for self-power, Maya Prakriti Shakti.
So I think we'll take that up next time because it's already 9 o'clock. This is really the crux of the passage that, I mean, the paragraphs that we've been studying lately, this final phase, and he brings it all together over here. It's very powerful, and gives us also the aim that he has sort of laid out, which is essentially that it's only by forming something beyond where we are right now, and it is only by that power, the power of the Shakti, that we can be led into that particular form in which we can experience both the unity and the duality of this Brahman, who is at the same time all these things, these double existences.
Sure, Devashish, we can stop here and continue next time.
Okay.
So we'll stop here. It's June 13th. So I think the next class will be June 27th. Are you up to date?
Correct. Okay. Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
So let's stop here and we'll continue June 27th. Thank you everybody for joining. I'll cut the call and upload the recording pretty soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Devashish. Oh,
thank you, Devashish.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
See you next
Good
time.
Night. See you next time.
Thank you.